Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Susan Yaki reporting. 50 dead, shooting at gay club. A gunman behind the killing of 50 people in an Orlando, Florida nightclub early today has reportedly been identified as Omar Sadiqi Mateen, a U.S. citizen of Afghan descent. An FBI official said the attack, believed to be the worst mass shooting in the history of the United States, is being investigated as an act of terrorism. Police stormed the building, fatally shooting the suspect and rescuing clubgoers trapped inside. 53 people were wounded. Orlando Police Chief John Minna told reporters how the case began.
We had an officer working at Pulse Nightclub who responded to shots fired. Our officer engaged in a gun battle with that suspect. The suspect at some point went back inside the club where more shots were fired. This did turn into a hostage situation. From there, obviously multiple officers from various agencies responded. SWAT team responded.
It's devastating. You know, you don't want this to happen anywhere in the world, okay? But, you know, I can tell you, law enforcement, our elected officials, the mayors, at the state level, we work coordinator activities hoping this would never happen. We work with the federal government hoping this would never happen. But it's devastating when you see how many people lost their life and just the impact it's going to have on their families. I've got kids and grandkids.
That was Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, becoming emotional about the shooting. President Barack Obama has been briefed by his counterterrorism and homeland security advisor and is asked to receive regular updates. This is VOA News. Libya's UN-negotiated unity government is claiming an offensive that's close to driving Islamic State militants from the coastal city of Sirte is evidence it is making progress at last in establishing its credibility. The offensive, which has made rapid advances in the past 3 days, is boosting hopes the struggling government of National Accord may be able to build up a new Libyan army on the back of the success and encourage militias loyal to a rival government in the east of the country to defect. The International Labor Organization is spearheading a global campaign to stamp out child labor, which victimizes 168 million children worldwide. Lisa Schlein reports from ILO headquarters in Geneva.
Most child labor occurs in production for domestic markets, but children also produce goods and services for export. It mainly occurs in the rural and informal economy. Director General of the International Labor Organization, Guy Ryder, says the combined efforts of governments, employers, workers' unions, and consumers are needed to end this nefarious practice. He says enterprises need to be vigilant to ensure their supply chains are free of child labor. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Philippines President Benigno Aquino today appealed to Filipinos to defend their freedom and democracy and remain vigilant as he warned the horrors of martial law under the late Ferdinand Marcos could happen again.
Kung hindi tayo magiging mapagmatsyag, maaari itong mangyari uli.
Aquino spoke as the country began the 118th Independence Day celebration. As the Philippines prepares for a change in leadership, some people fear Aquino's successor, Rodrigo Duterte, could take a more authoritarian path. FIFA, the international governing body of soccer, says idiotic troublemakers caused shameful violence at football games Saturday in two French cities, and the organization strongly condemned the unrest. More than 35 people were injured in Marseille after British and Russian soccer fans brawled in and around the Stade Velodrome. After the European Cup tournament game ended in a tie, Russian supporters charged the English side, forcing fans to flee and climb fences in a desperate bid to escape. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who waged a months-long battle with presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton, says he will meet with her after the last party primary Tuesday in Washington to discuss their political agendas before deciding whether to drop out of the race. Sanders told NBC's Meet the Press today that defeating the presumptive Republican nominee Trump is his first priority. Reporting to you from Washington, the nation's capital, I'm Susan Yawkey.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
President Lungu has been very consistent in calling for peace, calling for mutual respect, calling for issue-based campaigns.
Zambian President Edgar Lungu calls for peace as political parties campaign in readiness for the upcoming August 11 general election.
I think naturally we're not immune to all of these things that are taking place. Some of our currencies got devalued quite a bit in the last 12 months.
Africa's youngest billionaire says the continent seeks to do business with the rest of the world, not sympathy.
We are at a very crucial stage of our unity, of our development, and we all need to be extremely humble.
And participants at a conference in South Sudan calls on women to lead efforts to help resolve the challenges. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Malawi Law Society has expressed concern about the mass resignation at the Anti-Corruption Bureau. Officials say the resignations could be due to poor working conditions and the lack of workers' personal safety. This after what they said was an apparent targeted killing of one of their colleagues. Kumbo Soko, the General Secretary of the Malawi Law Society, told me the resignations will undermine the country's fight against graft.
Obviously, it's quite a sad development and one that sets back our fight against graft and corruption in the country. It's something that has been happening for quite some time now, and I think one can only speculate as to the reasons. Perhaps the workplace is no longer as competitive as it used to be. We've been facing quite a number of challenges in the country, and it won't be surprising if the Bureau were not able to offer its employees a package that motivated them to remain, considering the challenges they face in their role. But also, I think the scandal, the massive looting of public resources, what has come to be known as Caspia, as it resulted in a significant threat to the security of those that work in the Bureau. And you recall that a couple of months ago, a senior officer of the Bureau was killed in what appeared to be a targeted assassination. And so there are also incidents where people no longer feel the guarantee of their safety. And, as a result, maybe the only option that they're able to exercise to leave.
Malawians I spoke with said the government should do more to protect life and property. Not only that, but those particularly working in the Anti-Corruption Bureau because of the sensitive nature of the work they do. What is your reaction to that?
I mean, absolutely. It's a call we would want to associate ourselves with. We've actually made similar calls in the past. To say that at least those that are in the front line, doing this very dangerous work should at least be given some basic guarantees of security. There's been some attempts, we must say, but obviously I don't think everyone who is in need of security has been provided security, and that's quite worrying.
Wouldn't this be a worry to all Malawians, particularly when the government has said repeatedly that it wants to root out corruption in the southern African country?
Yeah, of course it is a worry. Because already the bureaus and the staff, and when you have people mass working out, then it compromises the ability of the bureau to do what it was set out for. We hope that the national interventions are going to take place, so at least we can arrest this massive resignation. But otherwise, it's a worry, and it undermines the fight against graft.
Mr. Soko, what will the Malawi Law Society do in its capacity as an advocacy group and a bunch of lawyers who are seeking the well-being of Malawians to ensure equal justice before the law? What will you do in your capacity to cooperate with the government or at least put pressure on the authorities to try to resolve some of these concerns?
Well, I mean, we've been talking with the leadership at the highest, you know, the highest level possible to register our concerns, and you know, we'll continue to do that. We've been engaging Parliament as well to ensure that the resources that are made available to the Bureau are increased. You might be aware that you know, our Parliament is in session right now, considering the budget for the next 12 months, and we've been in touch with the leadership of the Parliament to ensure that at least, you know, the resource allocation to the Bureau and indeed other law enforcement agencies is increased to reflect our national commitment to the fight against graft and corruption.
Kumbo Soko is the General Secretary of the Malawi Law Society. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Zambian President Edgar Lungu has called on citizens to desist from violence as political parties campaign ahead of the upcoming August 11 general election. But opposition supporters say members of the governing Patriotic Front Party are to blame for the election-related violence. They accused the ruling party supporters of intimidation, harassment, and destroying opposition campaign materials. For reaction regarding the allegations, I reached Frank Bwalya, Deputy Campaign Manager for the ruling Patriotic Front Party.
President Lungu has been very consistent in calling for peace, calling for mutual respect, calling for issue-based campaigns. His message has not only started now, but that has always been his message. He's a man who believes in peaceful coexistence in our democratic dispensation. So he has continued to call for restraint. He has continued to call for peace, and to make sure that our party conducts our campaigns in a manner that would help to improve the democratic credentials of our country, meaning that the elections should be free and fair, free of violence.
Some people have said that the president's call is inconsistent with what some PF cadres are doing by clearly going out and provoking other opposition party supporters and burning their campaign memorabilia and all that. And they say that the president should call on his own cadres to stop all kinds of violence or provoking the others. What do you say to such criticisms, Father Bwalya?
Specifically, the UPND. The UPND is always projecting what they do onto others. They are the ones who are intimidating our supporters in their only stronghold, the southern province of Zambia. They are intimidating our people there, beating them up, and when somebody uses our party, Chitenge, to use as a flag that erects on their business premises or indeed their own dwelling, they go there, pull it down, and beat them up. Because what UPND believes is that as long as they make it difficult for us to come in their stronghold, and yet we are allowing them to campaign in our own strongholds, then they can win this election. This is what has been happening. We have made several reports to the police about our billboards, campaign posters, and so on, being bent down, torn by suspected UPND cadres.
Father Bwalya, the president is also quoted as saying by the local media, are saying that the police can step aside if they can't do their jobs by ensuring peace and stability and enforcing the law to ensure there is no violence. Who else should step in if the police should step aside, if I may ask?
It's an expression that the president has used once, which doesn't literally mean that the police should, relegate their job to another organization, not at all. And Zambians do know that the president doesn't mean that. However, they twist it to make some cheap political mileage.
The UPND has come out to say that the choice of Geoffrey Mwamba as the vice presidential candidate, who was a financier and a cabinet minister in the Patriotic Front government and a close ally
of deceased President Michael Chulufya-Sata, as well as the vice president and a prominent member in last year's PF, joining forces with Hakainde Hichilema of the UPND means the end of the government of the PF in August 11 general election. What do you say to that?
Yeah, the UPND has always overrated itself when they catch a recycled politician, a finished politician. They try to ascribe value that is far beyond the value of such a politician. GBM was not a founding member of PF. He joined PF many years after it was formed.
Frank Bwalya is the deputy campaign manager for the Zambian ruling Patriotic Front Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Ashish Thaka is often described as Africa's youngest billionaire. Just 34 years old, he runs the Mara Group, a business that employs some 11,000 people in 25 countries. He's also chair of the United Nations Foundation's Global Entrepreneurs Council and has created a foundation to support African entrepreneurs. Ashish Thaka told me Africa is ready to conduct business with the world.
The reality is, Peter, with commodity prices being where they are, China's slowdown, IMF revising growth rates across emerging markets in general, but particularly our continent, I think naturally we're not immune to all of these things that are taking place. Some of our currencies got devalued quite a bit in the last 12 months. However, there is still genuine growth. So we as Mara and our businesses, such as our bank Atlas Mara and other businesses, we're very bullish and excited that this is still a fantastic time to be active on our continent. And I think people need to realize, and now more than ever, that we're not a short-term win as a continent. You know, we're medium to long-term strategy. And people who have that medium to long-term mindset, we are the perfect investment destination as a continent.
So how is the Mara Group of companies doing in Africa at the moment?
It's doing great. With God's grace, you know, there's been fantastic growth across the group in the various sectors. This year is a big year for Mara. We turned 20 years old in August, so it's going to be our 20-year anniversary. And to be perfectly honest, Peter, I think as cheesy as it sounds, I think we're just getting started as Mara.
As an investor, as somebody who comes from Africa, what are some of the challenges for investors from the continent as well as from the international community who invest in Africa?
I think, look, when you think about the macros of Africa, the fact that we have over 52 cities with over a million people, the fact that we've got a population of over a billion people, the fact that we've got over 700-800 million mobile phone users, the fact that we've got the most naturally rain-fed arable land in the world, all these facts are very compelling. People get too carried away with the theoretical side of us as a continent versus the practical. I'll give you an example. People would create a Southern African head office and put it in South Africa, yet that person who's heading that Southern African office hasn't been to four of the 18 SADC countries. And that's where the theory gets carried away. And I think that is the challenge that African businesses, but more so global businesses, face.
So what do you think are the solutions to resolving this, to make Africa practical, pragmatic, to ensure its growth opportunity that you see, that you worked under?
One country makes a mistake, the entire continent is generalized. Three of our countries have Ebola and people stop traveling to the entire continent. It's this ignorance or lack of know-how that really hurts us as a continent and hurts the potential that these global companies have to participate in our growth. So I think what's important is we've got to tell our own story. We've got to change the narrative and make it more of one of reality. And it needs to become more realistic. People need to start paying attention to the real facts and not get carried away with certain headlines which don't give the real story.
Ashish, governments across Africa have always been said to have talked a good game but have not implemented policies that will attract the private sector to invest or to partner with the private sector to improve the living conditions of the people. What do you think governments can do
differently that will make the environment attractive enough for people to invest?
I think what needs to be done better, I think our borders need to open up quicker, because collectively as open markets we're a much bigger target than just individual countries. So regional integration does need to be fast-tracked. Free movement of people and goods, particularly goods, I think is a very important angle. Standardizing laws and policies as much as possible. But at the same time, you know, learning from the best examples, and that doesn't necessarily need to be from within our continent. Taking examples from other countries in Latin America or Asia that have done it very well.
In the next 5, 10, 15 years, what do you want to see in Africa happen?
My dream and our vision as the Mara Foundation is that I want to see a self-sustainable Africa. I've said it before, we don't need people to feel sorry for us. We don't need people's pity. We want to do business, we want investment, we want to do trade, and not necessarily aid.
Ashish Thakkar is often described as Africa's youngest billionaire. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Participants at a public forum in the South Sudanese capital, Juba, on women's role in government agree that women must be steadfast in presenting their agenda and work hand in hand with men to address the challenges the country faces. This, they said, includes the need to restore peace and stability in the world's newest nation. For VOA, Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Those are tens of women applauding a speaker during yesterday's public dialogue at the University of Juba main campus. The dialogue was aimed at gathering views to be included in a national strategy for enhancing women's participation in the transitional government of national unity. Pauline Riak, Deputy Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at the University of Juba, says both men and women can play similar roles in governance. She says, like men, women should speak out about issues affecting the country and be allowed to participate in making political decisions.
We are at a very crucial stage of our, a delicate stage of our unity, of our development, and we all need to be extremely humble, men and women, and to work with each other, to respect each other, to recognize that all of us, whoever we are, whatever age, all of us are citizens of this country and therefore entitled to equal treatment under the law.
Riak says South Sudanese men and women together should focus on restoring peace and stability in the country as a top priority.
I think each of us as individuals have an obligation to work in whatever ways we find possible, wherever we find ourselves, to work with each other, to work for the benefit of this country, instead of continuing to criticize and to complain and to carry it down.
Merikaje Lona, Secretary General of South Sudan Democratic Engagement Monitoring and Observation Program, says South Sudanese society does not value women as equal players or stakeholders in the democratization process. Lona says many people view women as being inferior to men, and that is why women are not allowed to participate in important decisions.
Take note of, like right now, the conversation about the selection of the speaker for transitional National Legislative Assembly. I think it's only normal for us to embrace the reality of life that women have what it takes, and it will only be normal for us to have a woman take up that position, because we are having the three arms of government. The executive is entirely led by men. The judiciary is entirely led by men. It will not be a mistake to see a woman heading the legislative arm of the government.
Rajab Mohandis, Executive Director of South Sudanese Network for Democracy and Elections, says women should have a clear agenda and a strategy on what they want to achieve.
We have seen women engaging in a lot of activities, but sometimes you don't see a clear outcome of some of these activities.
Benny Gideon, a member of the South Sudan Law Society, agrees with Mohandis and notes that South Sudan's legal instruments have remained the same despite new language in the constitution regarding women. He says Article 15 of the South Sudan Transitional Constitution empowers women to participate at all levels of government.
To the regional level, there is a Mobutu Protocol, which is known as the Protocol, the African Commission on Human and People Rights, specifically relating to the right of women to participate in political decision-making process, as well as the UN Security Council Resolution 1325.
Gideon says the problem is not having appropriate laws, but rather the lack of enforcement of laws already in the Constitution. For VOA News, I am Waka Simon Wudu in Juba.
The International Labour Organization is spearheading a global campaign to stamp out child labour, which victimizes 168 million children worldwide. To mark this year's World Day Against Child Labour, a panel of experts focused on the abusive and widespread practice of child labour in international supply chains. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The choir for the abolition of child labor, a group of young musicians from Ivory Coast, spreads its message that children belong in school, not at work. The pulsing beat of the music and the rap lyrics set the right note for the high-level panel discussion on ending child labor in supply chains. Under this system, children are employed all along the line, from the manufacture of a product to its final distribution to the consumer. It involves workers, small producers, and enterprises around the world. Most child labor occurs in production for domestic markets, but children also produce goods and services for export. It mainly occurs in the rural and informal economy. Director General of the International Labor Organization, Guy Ryder, says the combined efforts of governments, employers, workers' unions, and consumers are needed to end this nefarious practice. He says enterprises need to be vigilant to ensure their supply chains are free of child labor.
From enterprises, we need a clear message of zero tolerance of child labor. They need to know what is happening in their supply chains and to back that up with action in their business practices and dealings with suppliers. And this, I believe, is the common expectation of business in the 21st century.
Children work for low or no pay in abusive, slave-like and dangerous conditions in agriculture, fishing, garment industries, electronics, manufacturing, and in the mineral extractive sector. Jacqueline Mugo is executive director of the Federation of Kenya Employers. She says employers worldwide are tackling the problem of child labor. In some cases, she says, employers will not hire children if the work is seen to cause hardships to the children or their families.
Because in East Africa, we found that actually child labor was in many cases exacerbated by families that needed their income. And so it's important to take this into consideration, and there are programs that have been implemented to do this.
But Philip Jennings, General Secretary of Uni Global Union, a worldwide workers' movement, says not enough is being done.
It was Timothy Leary that said, tune in, turn on, and drop out. There are 168 million reasons why we, as a community, cannot drop the ball and drop out of the conversation on child labour.
Jennings agrees progress is being made. He notes child labour has been cut by one-third in the last decade, and governments have committed themselves to eliminating child labour by 2025.
The clock is running. The time for excuses from business is over. And we simply don't buy the argument that it's all the fault of government. We want business to accept its responsibility and to work with the social partners and local governments to ensure that child labour isn't a reality.
The panelists agree a key element in eradicating child labor is to provide decent jobs to adults and youth of working age. Some of the participants are calling on the ILO to enact a convention on supply chains that spells out the rules for ending child labor in this complex global system. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And right now, it's time for Africa Sports. And for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, says the suspension on Benin has been lifted after the Football Federation held its elections on Friday, a day later than scheduled and despite a court injunction. The team had been serving a ban from world football, which could only be lifted if their federation polls were held by June 11th. Benin were keen to do so in order to play Equatorial Guinea in a 2017 Africa Cup of Nations qualifier on Sunday and avoid disqualification. Benin need to win their final two games against Equatorial Guinea and Mali to qualify for the Nations Cup as the winners of Group C. In athletics, there will be 11 gold medals, 59 world titles, and 7 world leads on the combined resumes of the athletes who are set to appear in Stockholm on June 16th at the 8th leg of the IAAF Diamond League. 4 of the top 5 finishers from the 800 meters final at the IAAF World Championships Beijing 2015 will meet again over 2 laps of the track. Olympic champion David Rudisha faces 2013 world champion Muhammad Aman, European champion Adam Kazot, Kenya's Ferguson Cheruiyot, and French record holder Pierre Ambroise Bosse. World indoor 3,000-meter champion Yomin Kajelp and 2011 world 10,000-meter champion Ibrahim Jaylan might provide the toughest opposition for fellow Ethiopian and world leader Mukhtar Idris in the 5,000 meters. Sprint hurdle sensation Kendra Harrison goes up against two-time world indoor champion Nia Ali and European champion Alina Tele, who recently broke her own Belarusian record with 12.63. But all eyes in the Olympic Stadium will be on Susan Kalla, Sweden's world indoor record holder, who will run her first 100-meter hurdles race since 2010. Since recording the second fastest steeplechase performance in history, Ruth Jepet has been training hard back home. The Asian record holder will take on Olympic champion Habiba Gribi, who will be making her 2016 debut. World leader Shante Lowe will take on two-time European champion Ruth Bechia and 2014 world indoor champion Camila Lochwinko in the high jump. Meanwhile, Morule Ahore of the Ivory Coast broke the African 100-meter record when she ran 10.78 at the Star Athletics Pro Meet in Florida on Saturday. The 28-year-old's run put her at the top of the world list and brought her home marginally in front of Jamaica's Veronica Campbell-Brown, who was runner-up in 10.83. Ahore's run beat the African record of 10.79 held by Nigeria's Blessing Okabare since 2013 and took 300th of a second off her previous best of 10.81, which was run in London last July. Tyson Gay took victory in the men's 200 meters in 20.21 ahead of Justin Walker, who ran 20.26. The men's 100 meters saw a sub-10 clocking from USA's Marvin Bracey, who routed the field to win in 9.94 ahead of runner-up Aaron Brown, 10.01, and Clayton Vaughn, 10.02. Candice Price impressed when winning the 100 meters hurdles in 12.75, while the men's 110 meters hurdles saw Devon Hill edge USA compatriot Antoine Hicks in a tight race. In tennis, Andy Murray has reunited with former coach Ivan Lendl. Murray has been without a coach since splitting with Amelia Maresmo shortly before the French Open last month. The Scot won Wimbledon, the U.S. Open, and Olympic gold during 2 years of Lendl from 2012 to 2014. Murray became the first British Wimbledon champion for 77 years when he won the title in 2013. He is ranked second in the world and has reached both Grand Slam finals in 2016, losing to Serbian world number one Novak Djokovic at the Australian and French Opens. Finally, on a sad note, Shuaibu Amodu, the only man to have qualified Nigeria for two World Cup finals, has died at the age of 58. Amodu, who coached Nigeria on four different occasions, is thought to have passed away in his sleep in the southern Nigerian city of Benin after complaining of chest problems. The death comes just days after former Nigerian coach and captain Stephen Keshi passed away aged 54 in the same city. Amodu, who first took charge of Nigeria at the age of 36, was approached to replace Sunday Oliseh in February, but declined on health ground, according to the country's football authority. Amodu first showed prominence when he guided Nigeria's side BCC Lions of Boko to win the now-defunct Africa Cup Winners' Cup in 1990. 3 years later, Amodu replaced Dutchman Clemens Westerhof as Nigeria's coach in 1994 and then led reigning African champions to fourth place at the 1995 King Ford Cup, now renamed FIFA Confederation Cup, before his exit later that year. He helped the country to qualify for the 2002 World Cup in Japan and South Korea and led them to a third place finish in the 2002 Nations Cup. Under his stewardship, Nigeria qualified for the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, but Amodu was sacked despite the team's third-place finish at the 2010 Africa Cup of Nations with Angola. He was also very successful at club level, also managing South Africa's giant Orlando Pirates between 1996 and 1997. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
Robina Samia, ah, boy, swaru bibia mama tia. Mala
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. On June 7th, President Salva Kiir of South Sudan and his first deputy, Riek Machar, co-authored an op-ed piece in America's paper of record, the New York Times. This article sought to amend the agreement reached last August that produced the unity government in South Sudan. That agreement had provided for the establishment of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, as well as a hybrid court. Now, the article was arguing that the preference of the government would be that there should be only the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and to abandon the notion of a hybrid court. Of course, this has caused some controversy inside South Sudan because there are South Sudanese who believe that you need a court. The problem that one sees with these two models is that many people do not understand the reasons why they were established and why they were necessary. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission worked very well in South Africa because of the conditions of the country when they were negotiating to end apartheid. On the African side, they were blessed to be led by Nelson Mandela, and also on the side of the apartheid regime by President de Klerk. But they have parties who are not in support of negotiations. Among the Africans, the Pan-African Congress, PNC, did not want negotiations with the apartheid regime, which they called the Boer regime. And on the part of the white community, extremist whites were prepared to fight to the finish, even though South Africa was becoming a pariah state because of the sanctions imposed by the international community. They also was very fortunate in South Africa that the chairman of the Peace and Reconciliation Commission was Reverend Bishop Desmond Tutu, and he performed very, very well in an even-handed way, and everyone recognized that it served its purpose. But we should not also forget what are the terms of the Reconciliation Commission. The first is that all those who may have committed atrocities should come before the commission and confess their crimes, and they might be forgiven, and there will be reconciliation. But if there are South Africans who did not come before the commission and they are found out to have committed crimes, they would be prosecuted. And it was generally believed that atrocities were committed on both sides. The hybrid force court was a product of Sierra Leone. There was no doubt anywhere that major atrocities were committed during the conflict, particularly after the establishment of the civilian regime in 1998. It was agreed on one side, and I must say the government was not unanimous, that there should go through an international tribunal, such as the ad hoc tribunals for Yugoslavia or the ad hoc tribunal in the Arusha process. But there were other ministers who believed that Sierra Leone has credible courts and legal system and they should do it. But they recognized too that such a trial by the Sierra Leone government alone would lack credibility internationally, and this would not be acceptable, as we are now seeing in the courts in La Côte d'Ivoire, where the Gbagbo supporters are criticizing the government for prosecuting only their side. As a result, the government of Sierra Leone approached the United Nations, and there were technical talks between the legal department of the United Nations and the Attorney General's office. This is how the hybrid court emerged. There was one problem with the hybrid court, that is financing it. Whereas the ad hoc tribunals of Arusha and Yugoslavia were paid fully by the United Nations, that for Sierra Leone was paid by voluntary contribution. And history will show that it's a weak instrument to finance by voluntary contribution. So it worked well. But there was also a problem, because when Chief Norman was brought before the court, it caused fissures within the ruling party and in the country. So these two models have been side by side. And it seems that the agreement in South Sudan was trying to follow the model in Sierra Leone, where you have both the hybrid court and the Reconciliation Commission. So one would hope that in South Sudan, they should look at how these two models of approach been applied, not only in South Africa, but in Northern Ireland, and also how the hybrid court has performed in Sierra Leone. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, the affable Michael Dubinsky. We say thanks for joining us, and remember, as the elders say, do not argue with a fool, for people will not be able to tell between the two of you. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. and China just completed the eighth meeting of the U.S.-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue. Both countries found common ground on issues including strategic, environmental, and humanitarian matters. A top agenda item was North Korea. The United States and China condemned North Korea's January 6, 2016 nuclear test and subsequent launches using ballistic missile technology and called on North Korea to cease taking actions contrary to its United Nations obligations to denuclearize. The U.S. and China agreed to promote the implementation of the Paris Global Climate Agreement and bring it into force as soon as possible. With regard to protecting the oceans, the United States and China agreed to work together and with other governments to complete negotiations on an agreement to prevent unregulated commercial fishing in the central Arctic Ocean. In order to enhance global nuclear security, the U.S. and China decided to explore expanding cooperation on countering nuclear smuggling. On the humanitarian front, the U.S. and China agreed to increase their support for the Syrian refugees and internally displaced persons through the UN, Red Cross, Red Crescent, and their partners, and to continue providing support for Iraqi refugees and internally displaced persons. In Africa, the two countries decided to accelerate cooperation with the African Union and its member states to launch the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The U.S. and China will also increase their contributions to countries adversely affected by El Niño, particularly in the Horn of Africa, through the World Food Program. The U.S. and China decided to explore new areas of development cooperation in Afghanistan and food security in Timor-Leste and Africa. Both sides also agreed to promote responsible mineral supply chain practices in the African Great Lakes region. This annual dialogue, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, offers the U.S. and China an opportunity to lead in the direction of stability, prosperity, and peace. And it is up to us and to our successors to ensure that America and China are more partners than rivals, more in agreement than disagreement about the rule of law, more in harmony than at odds over priorities, and more confident with each passing year in each other's intentions.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.